You may lead in the wrong direction. You may not succeed in getting to where you go. But it does. It seems that our, to me, our society has to be more intolerant of people who get themselves in leadership position and then do nothing but, you know, then dig a moat around themselves to protect themselves from losing that position.
Hi, this is Jib Ellison, and I'm founder of Blue Sky. And we've been producing these podcasts now for a while on a weekly 10 and 2 report. You may recall these are 10 things that interest us in any given week, provided to you in about 2 minutes or as short a time as we can. Now, we're unveiling a new periodic podcast that we're calling Leadership in the 22nd Century. Our current social and economic systems were designed in and for a different time, namely the 19th and 20th centuries, a time when there was a lot less people changing life on Earth, a lot slower, and a lot less systematically. Today, each day we add approximately 200,000 new people to the 7+ billion occupying our beautiful blue orb floating through space. Add to this the addition of tech innovations associated with machine learning, DNA manipulation, and flash stock trading, and we are living in the midst of a volatile cocktail that is manifest in unusual politics and a broad sense of dissatisfaction. To quote Charles Dickens, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. For the last 15 years, we've worked with CEOs, corporations, nonprofits, foundations, and even a city on taking action to build long-term resilience and sustainability in light of these trends. Along the way, I've met a lot of interesting people engaged in what I've come to call the act of history making. These are leaders who are actively transforming the way that human beings see the world. Known examples are people like Steve Jobs, Albert Einstein, and Desmond Tutu. In our case, we're going to focus this podcast on a subset of history makers, namely leaders who are actively working to help people appreciate the beauty, utility, and fundamental necessity of a healthy environment to a thriving human existence. These 22nd century leaders are applying the best human leadership capabilities to successfully helping us, their fellow humans, through what is sure to be a very turbulent transition from an economics built for 19th century realities to a society and economics built for 22nd century realities. We began this podcast a few weeks back with an interview with biodynamic farmer Paul Dolan, and today we're shifting towards the energy sector with an interview of my friend David Crane. I first met David when we were navigating the rapids of California's Tuolumne River together in 2010, and was here watching his powerful strokes through the Class 5 rapids and hearing his stories around the campfire that I realized that this was no ordinary guy. At the time, and until 2 years ago when he was fired, David was CEO of NRG, America's largest electrical power generation company. During his 12-year tenure, he took NRG out of Chapter 11 bankruptcy and grew it into a Fortune 200 company. He was midway on transforming this, one of America's dirtiest companies, to become a green leader by focusing on green retail, large-scale renewables, home solar, electrical vehicle charging, and portable solar. As you'll hear, David is outspoken, articulate, and courageous, a true 22nd century leader. Okay, well, David Crane, welcome to the Blue Sky podcast. You've been part of the fossil fuel business for most of your career. And so how did you in particular come to believe that the future in energy systems around the world is going to be fossil fuel free?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's jarring to me to hear you say that you've been a part of the fossil fuel, you know, industry for your whole career, because that, you know, that's the way we never thought about it. You know, we always used to say that, you know, we were the electricity industry and, you know, we performed an essential, you know, service to society in terms of keeping the lights on. All of modern civilization was based on what we did. But of course, it was all fossil fuel based. And from my perspective, as an energy industry executive, you know, we've been dealing with the unwanted externalities of our business for a long time. for the entire time I was in the industry, for the entire 25 years. But initially, of course, it was SOX and NOX, and then it became mercury. And for me, and I admit I was a little late to the party, it only hit, you know, a lot of people have been talking about greenhouse gas emissions, but it really only hit for me about 10 years ago, which was a little bit late. And just the fact that this was a pollutant that was on a completely different scale in terms of the consequences than the ones that we had been dealing with before. And so, you know, that led me to believe that it wasn't going to be possible for us. Society was simply not going to allow us to continue to make electricity in the 21st century in the same way it had been made in the 20th century. And not only was society not going to allow it, but it was just sort of morally wrong to ignore it. And so that's why we looked around and, you know, we considered and spent a significant amount of money looking at all the low to zero carbon alternatives, including nuclear and carbon capture on fossil plants and, of course, renewables. And it was not clear 10 years ago that renewables were going to end up being the winner because they weren't nearly as inexpensive as they are now. And, you know, the issue of intermittency seemed like a much bigger issue then than it does now.
So, but I am still interested. I mean, so few of your peers, it seems, have at least publicly and in their actions come out so clearly in a leadership position for a different future. You know, how did you come to make the determination? Was it a moral decision, or was it a kind of a business decision, or both, that really you were going to step out from your peer group and stand up and say, hey, the future is not like the past?
Well, I mean, the moral aspect was always an important part of it to me personally, but if there wasn't a business justification for it, then, you know, maybe what I should have just done, if I only had a moral argument but not a business argument, maybe I should have just resigned and, you know, gone off and done something else. But there was a compelling business argument as well, in the sense that electricity, energy is a heavily regulated industry, and so you have to be in tune with societal trends. And if society is not going to let you do things a certain way, then there's a good business reason to change. The second thing was, it was clear that there was going to be a rapidly increasing demand for renewable power, admittedly from a small base. And in the electric industry, which does not naturally grow at any sort of significant rate, it's usually a fraction of GDP growth. The idea that you could be in an end of the industry that was growing at significant double-digit levels, you know, was a compelling business proposition as well. And that leads to the answer to your question, which is, well, if there's all these compelling business reasons, why, David, were you like the only conventional energy company CEO to come out so strongly in terms of doing something about climate change? And I would just say that maybe the difference between myself and other CEOs is that I got into the business, you know, I was comparatively young for an energy CEO. I mean, when I sort of got religion on climate change in 2006, I was, you know, I was 47 years old, which is still pretty young for a CEO. And so I expected to be around for, you know, 15 or 20 years. And one of the things I've noticed about business is you can tell the outlook horizon of a CEO by how many years they expect to continue to work. So given that most CEOs are in their late 50s in the energy industry, most of them have a short to medium term time horizon. And it's very easy, given how long the climate saga is going to unfold, and scientists talking about carbon emissions in 2050, if you're a CEO in 2017 and you plan to retire in 2022,
right?
It's very easy to ignore people telling you that you need to be worried about 2050.
Wow. But still, and again, on our theme of leadership for our time, or leadership towards a 22nd century, I find it fascinating and disturbing somewhat that so few CEOs who, many of whom, that I've talked to are quite intelligent. They tend to look at facts and data and believe in science, have, I think, quite frankly, chosen not to rigorously pursue, with some big exceptions, but to rigorously pursue an agenda that thoughtfully, in line with shareholder expectations and needs, puts things in place, and particularly in your industry. And are you just this probably gets to a little bit about your qualities. I don't suspect it has to do simply because you're a young CEO, but what qualities would you say you and other leaders that you've observed in this space have exhibited? What are the ones that make the difference, that allow people to step out from the crowd?
Well, I mean, Jib, let me answer that question on three different levels with three very different thoughts, but hopefully all of which will be interesting and somewhat relevant to you. The first is that I have never come across a CEO in the energy industry or in the energy producing industry or the energy consuming industry that denies climate change. I mean, I know in the United States, a fair amount of the political spectrum still wants to deny climate change, and CEOs tend to be actually pretty conservative in their political orientation. But the good thing about CEOs is that they're based on facts.
Right.
They live their life. And so I've never actually had a CEO say to me, this is just not an issue. What has surprised me is that sometimes they don't follow the logical chain. So to give you an example, I once heard the head of the biggest coal company in the United States say in a public forum, or at least a semi-public forum, that climate change was happening. It was an issue, but as far as he was concerned, it was only about 14th or 15th in terms of the importance, the priority of the issue relative to other major societal issues we have. Mm-hmm. And from my perspective, I almost sort of jumped up and said, why don't you just lie to us and tell us you don't believe climate change is happening? Because if you believe it's happening and you believe that we're fundamentally altering the earth in a way that's going to be devastating for future generations, there's no way that that's number 14 or 15. So at least have some intellectual consistency in right. what you're saying. So that's one thing. The second thing I would tell you, Jib, is that the element that we didn't, the third element when we were talking about the business rationale and the moral issue, there's a third element which I never got, which is the intergenerational issue, in the sense that, I mean, virtually every CEO I know is a family man or woman who has children of their own. One of the things that really got to me, and I was a relatively young CEO and I had children relatively late in life, was I would look at my children and say, how am I going to explain to these children when they're old enough to know my actions when I was put in a position to do something and I didn't do anything? And that's what I wonder, when I look at these other CEOs who are just sort of ignoring the issue, is, how do you go home and look at your children? Because you just you know, this idea that you can be one person at work and another person at home, that's just not the 21st century reality. You're the same person at home that you are at work.
Right.
So that's the second thing. The third thing, which most directly answers your question, is that one of the things that I find most disconcerting about our society, and this is not just about business leadership, is that we have these leadership positions, and NRG was a Fortune 500 company. So there's, by definition, 500 Fortune 500 CEOs, you know, sort of the recognized business leaders in the United States. It's a good gig being the CEO of a public company. They pay you a lot of money. You know, you get wined and dined. You get to do a lot of things that, you know, normal people don't get to do. You know, you've got, in my case, 11,000 people at NRG that would do whatever I told them to do, you know, within reason. And you get a lot of people that they get into these leadership positions and they become singularly focused on staying in those leadership positions. Mm-hmm. Rather than doing what I thought was important, is that you have a responsibility, if you're put in a leadership position, to actually try and lead. You may lead in the wrong direction. You may not succeed in getting to where you go. But it seems that our society has to be more intolerant of people who get themselves in leadership position and then do nothing but, you know, then dig a moat around themselves to protect themselves from losing that position.
Wow. So I got it as an intellectual, the three qualities, which I think are incredibly insightful, actually. Intellectual consistency, in the sense of if you do your research, you understand, in this case, that climate change is real, human beings are contributing to it, and we also have a role, probably a significant role, in mitigating the challenges. One should be intellectually consistent. Two, also incredibly important, the intergenerational piece. You know, I also, my company, Blue Sky, is named after my daughter, Sky. So it's very consistent with that. And by the way, just so you know, when we have done work with senior executive teams, educating them about these global trends and sustainability, we've always asked them at night to go back to their families and have around the dinner table, have a conversation with their kids if they're there. And their spouse, and just say, hey, we're thinking about doing something in this space. What do you think? And the responses across the board, with some very, very conservative people who I think were somewhat skeptical, were almost overwhelmingly, particularly from the young people, like, of course you should be doing this stuff. So I think that's makes sense. And then the last one is the one I'm most interested in, because it really does get to, you know, you should try to lead if you're in a leadership position and not just simply try and stay in power. And that seems to get to almost a human nature question, which was about another column that you wrote in. I have a couple columns that I'm interested in, but this reminds me about how, as a shareholder, you're glad that NRG perhaps is let's just say, not following the path that you had laid out for them in terms of a green energy future. But that seems to indicate that your market argument that these are good business decisions perhaps aren't true. So describe a little bit about why you think what they're doing as a shareholder might be good for you, at least in the short term, and how that contradicts your beliefs that it is the right thing to do from a business perspective.
Well, so it's a little bit nuanced, and you know, I don't know how much your listeners will know the NRG story, but I left there, you know, when we were trying to transform from a coal-based brown energy and driven electricity company to a renewables-based, and just in the last few weeks, they announced that they were getting rid of their remaining, you know, renewable business, and the stock went way up. Well, the nuance in it, Jib, is that when I left, several of the key aspects of what our going green strategy it consisted of were dismantled almost immediately. But the company continued to say that we are going green, but, you know, while they said they were going green, they were actually getting out of a couple of businesses that I thought were key to the future, the key to the future of a clean energy economy and the key to the future for the company.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, I had given up on NRG as and its transformation story well before this recent announcement. But people generally who didn't know as much about the company didn't, you know, they wanted to believe what the company had said. And so what I would say is the way I make those two things consistent is that, you know, it's a competitive world out there. If NRG in trying to go from brown to green was going to do it in a, you know, half-assed way, they weren't going to succeed in the first place. And mm-hmm. I think that's why the market, I mean, the market that drove up NRG stock 30% after the announcement that they were selling their renewables, that was not a vote by the market in favor of, oh, the future of electricity is coal-fired generation, it's not renewables. That was okay. Just the market saying, oh, good, NRG is going to stop wasting money going after pretending to be green in a half-assed way.
Got it. Well, to this point, you also wrote a recent article in Green Biz about, you know, your dream. And you called it my clean energy green dream. So tell us about what that is.
Well, the basis of that article was that at this point, change in the corporate world comes from a variety of different catalysts. It can come from the government, telling you to do something. That's not going to happen on climate change, at least for the next 4 years in the United States. It can come from people who you are competing against just coming up with a new way of doing things, and just everyone jumping over to that. Like if you think of, you know, when the consumer electronic industry decided to go to flat screen TVs and everyone went and it was supply side driven rather than demand pulled, because everyone on the supply side realized that sooner or later the consumer is going to figure out that the flat screen TV is better than, you know,
sliced
the Sony.
Bread.
Yeah, better than the Sony Trinitron. So they all jump in, and it was supply-driven for a wide variety of reasons. That's not going to happen in our industry. And it's not because renewables aren't cheaper or better than fossil fuel. It's just the nature of renewables means that if we all embrace renewables, the energy industry as it exists will lose their monopoly on basically providing us with energy. So they're opposed to it. So the only way that we're going to actually force the change in any sort of, you know, in a half generation or less, which is about how much time we have to do this, is for people on the demand side to drive change, to demand that suppliers give them renewable energy. And to me, the most potent force in that is big corporations, because if big corporations first say, you know, we want to be 100% renewable within 10 years or 15 years, then the supply side will start adapting to that. If a couple years later, those big corporations that go 100% renewables say to the companies that are supplying them with renewable power, oh, by the way, we're not going to do business with you if you're somewhere in your empire, you're producing fossil fuel fired generation, you know, that would have a big impact as well. It would be like, I mean, I'm sure Walmart, for instance, you know, would never consciously work with a company that was employing slave labor somewhere in the world, even if that slave labor was not being used to produce goods for Walmart. We're not there yet in terms of everyone feeling that strongly about climate change, but that's the most potent agent for change we have right now in terms of how energy is produced and consumed.
Well, if it were up to me, I'd vote for you to do that for sure. I think you should aggregate the buy for the world's largest corporations and just get to work on that. Maybe we should do a river trip on that subject.
That would be good.
No, because you know, there's part of when I listen to you, David, and reflect on, you know, we've known each other a while now and your accomplishments and the challenges that you faced, including leaving your job as CEO. There's a courage that goes along with actually trying to lead. But there's also a sense of you see possibility in places where I think a lot of people just see problems and outright impossibility. Can you tell me a little bit more about how is it that you can actually see what's possible? Because this is something I deal with on a fairly regular basis with my clients. You know, we do the analysis. The analysis clearly says this is a profitable investment, but it's going to require significant change of mindset and actual practices and processes inside your company, if not culture sometimes. And the barriers to getting these investments done are significant. And most people, when confronted with it inside the company, say impossible. And I feel like half my job is getting people to the point where they say possible. So reflect on that a little bit, because you seem to be and have no problem in the being in the real world. This is, again, my observation, understanding the nuances and the challenges, the real challenges and the barriers, but yet standing up and saying, no, this is possible. Here's how, and here's why we should do it. And that to me is leadership.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. Again, I'd offer you three quite different thoughts on that. Number one is that the problem that you alluded to in terms of getting a corporation, a successful corporation, a corporation that's succeeding at the top of its game and doing what it's doing now and saying you have to change what you're being successful at right now is very difficult. And I think one of the reasons that I became a controversial person and ended up, you know, getting fired is because to get the 11,000 people at NRG to believe in this brown to green transformation, one of the things I felt that I had to do was that I had to say to the people, look, I know we're very good at running coal-fired power plants, but there is simply no long-run future in doing this. And that worked in terms of the employees. The employees extremely appreciated that, including the ones working at the coal-fired power plants, where I was very popular, they appreciated that their company was trying to shift itself into 21st century energy production. But where it did work was with the investors. And I had plenty of investors who heard me say this, and they would say, well, we don't think someone who's, you know, trashing the future of coal-fired generation should be running a coal-fired company. And I would say things like, well, do you dispute that coal is on its way out? And they'd say, no. But you know, they have the opportunity when they decide that coal is done and, you know, solar and wind are the next thing, to simply sell the investment and invest in a solar or wind company. You know, we didn't have that opportunity internally. So probably what I should have done is hired Blue Sky to be the person saying that there's no future in coal, and then have everyone and say, see, we're just doing what Blue Sky.
Right.
But to your second point, you know, why did I see it and others don't? I always thought it was amusing. I had a reputation as being a quote unquote visionary in the electric space. And I said, no, I'm not a visionary. I'm just a historian. I'm just watching what's happened in Europe in the last 10 years, and it may not apply to all the industries that you and Blue Sky are working in, but in when it comes to carbon-free generation and transforming the electric system, Europe is roughly 10 years ahead of the United States. So if you want to know what's going to happen in the United States over the next 10 years, you just watch what's happened in Europe over the past 10. And the companies that clung to conventional fossil fuel-fired generation have gotten murdered. They've destroyed $1 trillion of market capitalization. So that's the second thing. But, Jib, there was a third thing that's really important that was embedded within your question, is that, you know, historically, carbon emissions, at least in the United States, the single biggest source has been our industry, the electric industry, close to 40% of total carbon emissions. The second biggest source was transportation, close to 30%. The electric industry, you know, too slowly, but certainly it's getting rid of coal. We're getting to an inflection point in our country generally where electric generation will no longer be the biggest source of carbon emissions. Transportation will be. And this should be obvious to everybody. The necessity of electrifying the transportation sector, the personal transportation sector, cars and light trucks, is essential. And when you add the technology that's coming along with self-drive, you know, automated cars, which most people will assume will be electric rather than fossil fuel driven, the opportunity to have this great economic outcome together with this fantastic environmental result is enormous. And it's not getting as much play outside of Northern California that it should. You see announcements like Volvo saying they won't make anything but alternative energy vehicles, you know, by 2019. You see France and Great Britain saying they're going to ban fossil fuel-fired cars in the 2030-2040 range. This is the next great revolution, and this is where it all needs to come together, both the electrified vehicles and how the electricity is made. And that's the most exciting thing out there right now. And it's huge.
Right. Yeah. And, first of all, do you have a little more time or are you, how much more time do you have?
Yeah, I probably have 5 more minutes.
Okay. Well, great. Well, I just wanted to use this opportunity to, ask you about Hawaii, because I was just reading recently that it just seems like the perfect test case. You may recall the Fossil Fuel Caribbean initiative that we were kicking around not too many years ago, but it's risen again in Hawaii, which seems to me to be a perfect place to have a vision like this, where the grid is synced with transportation, at least non-boat related transportation. Do you see that as possible, and what would it take to make a test case, a truly test case in the U.S. system?
Well, yes, I mean, Hawaii is trying to do great things, and they have a remarkable political consensus to 100% renewable energy, but to me, and I could be mistaken about this, they haven't connected all the pieces yet of saying, well, we need to do transportation and electricity side by side. They're sticking to the traditional sort of verticals in which all these different energy delivery systems live. I mean, the electric company in Hawaii, which is charged with making the electric system renewable, is not charged with turning Hawaii into a fossil fuel-free transportation zone, which is what...
Right.
And so I think Hawaii, which is aiming higher than any other state, just needs to aim even a little bit higher and then come up with a way between the public sector and the private sector to coordinate getting after it. And if they succeeded, I think it would be a game changer, and it would be one of the most exciting things that a person possibly could be involved with.
Yeah, that's great. Well, as we're kind of coming to a close, I am struck, having known you now, by your accomplishments in and around nature and those of your family as well. The first time we met was on a river trip here in California. And then I remember we had to rush you to the airport because you were getting on a plane to meet your family to climb Kilimanjaro. I'm just interested. Tell me a little bit about that side of who you are and what you do. What are some of your accomplishments mm-hmm. out there in the world? And I know your some of your kids have done some pretty amazing things. Tell me.
Well, Jib, it's nice of you to say it. And you know, my accomplishments, I'm just the bag carrier for the rest of my family. And you know, my wife is an ultra endurance athlete, and she particularly likes you know, trail races and things that go through interesting parts of the world. But you know, she's bequeathed that to our children, and we have, you know, five children coming of age, and we just have this thing in our family which sort of evolved that each of the child takes a gap year after high school, and then they do something that, you know, basically takes too long to do, you know, during the course of you know, summer break or something. And so our oldest child and the other part of it is that they each have to raise money for a cause of their choice, and they're supposed to raise the money that's sort of equivalent to the cost of whatever they decide to do. And so, you know, our first child climbed the seven summits. He became the first openly gay person to do it, and the fifth youngest. And our second child, our son, biked 12,000 kilometers across Africa. And he raised money for Conservation International, and you know, saw some of the good work they were doing in Africa as he rode through. Our third child, our only daughter, she walked the Pacific Crest Trail and raised money for the International Rescue Committee. And our fourth child is now starting, and I tell you this with deep ambivalence since I think it sounds a little crazy. He's planning on rowing across the Atlantic by himself, and he'd be the youngest person ever to solo row across the Atlantic. And it's not fully determined yet, but he obviously wants to raise awareness for oceans and raise money for ocean conservation. So you know, it's I'm just an amateur in my family, just trying to help them achieve their destiny.
Yeah, I remember fondly another time we met and you were limping a little bit. I said, "David, why are you limping?" He said, "Well, I came home after a business trip, and my wife informed me that I was going to run a marathon." So off the couch, you went and ran a marathon.
I tell you, Jib, it wasn't off a couch. Actually, I was at a cocktail party at 9 o'clock at night on a Saturday night with a glass of Chardonnay in my hand. And I said, "What are we doing tomorrow?" And she goes, "Oh, we got to get up early." I said, "Why we got to get up early?" She goes, "We're running a marathon. We're running the Bucks County Marathon." I'm like, "Could you have told me that?" Like,
well, yeah. It's very impressive, and I do look forward to doing some adventures with you in nature, and I really appreciate your coming on our podcast, and mostly really appreciate your leadership out there in the world. It's not easy. This is a major transformation underway throughout planet Earth of humanity, and I look forward to seeing what's next for you.
Well, thank you, Jib, and keep up the great work at Blue Sky.
Hi, Zach here. Just chiming in to remind you that the links for further reading about our guest and the articles referenced during the episode can be found on our website, bluesky.com, where of course you will remember that the E is in the wrong place. See you next time.